Hello and welcome to the Martian Driving Podcast number 42. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're doing something from the 70s and something from the 60s. The something from the 60s is It, starring Roddy McDowall, a Gollum movie that is deeply and funnily weird. And then we go to 1974 for a very strange Saul Bass-directed science fiction movie, Phase 4, starring Nigel Davenport and Michael Murphy. So grab some beer and a popcorn, sit back, I'll get the contact details and the Patreon campaign details out of the way, and we'll start the show. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show.
So how is everybody doing? We're a couple of days away from spring here, which is kind of nice, though it didn't come nearly fast enough for me. And I've been watching a few things, doing a few things, doing the radio gig. Met up with a friend of the podcast, one of my Patreon subscribers, and that was kind of cool too. The guy's name's Tom Dale, and Tom's going to be the guest on the next Paleo Cinema podcast. We're doing The Third Man and The Country Girl for that, so that's something to look forward to. So Tom and I recorded that on Wednesday via Skype, and then on Thursday met up at a little bar in Melbourne, had a couple of drinks and kind of got to know each other a little bit. And that was kind of cool too. See, that's the kind of stuff you can get if you're a Patreon subscriber and you, if you live in Melbourne at least. But one way or the other, you can get the opportunity to be on the show, talk about a movie you like, and have a groovy time of it. So what else? Any other news? Sal and I are going out country tomorrow. We're travelling 4 hours out of town for a barbecue, but we're going to stay overnight in a motel out at Warrnambool and then come back again on Monday and just going to have a couple of days off and a little bit of a chill out and then come back on Monday. So that's going to be kind of cool. And in October, at the beginning of October, we're travelling up to Sydney for my sister's wedding. My sister Linda is getting married, and I'm giving her away at the wedding, and I can always do the joke that I'm giving her away because I couldn't sell her on eBay. So I'm really looking forward to that. It's going to be just such a lovely thing, catching up with the family and doing the right thing by my sister. Being the oldest male of the family, I've suddenly become the patriarch of the family in some ways. And so I'm going to be walking her down the aisle, and I really feel honoured to do that. So that's going to be just a groovy thing for us. It does mean I'm going to have to front load the podcast a little bit, so I'm getting a few episodes up my sleeve, which is not a bad thing, and for both podcasts, really, come to think of it. But so Sydney in October is a very nice time to be up at my hometown, and I'll be doing the groovy thing. So if you follow on the Facebook page at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook, there should be a few photos and other things posted there for that trip up to Sydney. So what have I been watching? Now, because I recorded with Tom only a day or so ago, and you can hear the clicking there from the mouse, so I apologise for that. I haven't watched a hell of a lot, really, since then. A few things. I've got a recommendation for you. You're going to have to get a torrent of this because it's not available in any other means, unfortunately, though it could be worth your while tracking down. It's a TV series, a Canadian TV series that the Sci-Fi Channel did in 1998 called Welcome to Paradox, which is all set in a futuristic city called Betaville, kind of Alphaville but one down. And what they've done is adapted a bunch of short stories by science fiction writers to the format of the TV series, which is kind of cool. The budgets weren't fantastically large, and it's very late 90s kind of futures in them, a little bit of virtual reality happening there, a little bit of genetic engineering and all that sort of thing. But they adapted some stories from some decent science fiction writers, including two stories by John Varley, Options and Blue Champagne, which kind of work well. They're more about the impact of people of new technology. So I've been watching a few of those. They're a bit hit and miss, but it's interesting catching up on these kind of forgotten things from about 15 years ago, which are part of the genre and really don't get enough love. So that's Welcome to Paradox, if you're interested. So what else have I been watching? Let me see. For the radio gig, Liz Travaskis and I did pump up the volume of Christian Slater, where he plays a kind of teenage kid who starts a pirate radio station in a town where the high school has some problems. And that, we kind of enjoyed that. That was fun. The music's very good. It's filmed in 1990. So there's a lot of late 80s and 90s rock stuff happening there. And I've sounded really old by saying rock stuff. But anyway, we kind of enjoyed that. Next one we're doing is one of my favourite foodie movies of all time, which is Big Night, starring Stanley Tucci and Tony Shalhoub, amongst others. So we're going to look forward to watching that next week and talking about it on Thursday night on the radio gig. So apart from that, two things I've been watching, which I kind of, sort of, might recommend. I rewatched Minority Report, the 2004 movie starring Tom Cruise, which has already dated itself in a couple of ways, but I'll leave those for you to find, even though it's set in 2054, I think it is. There are already anachronisms in it from our point of view. So there you go, 10 years on, suddenly the future looks totally different. And the most recent Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, Sabotage, where he plays the head of a DEA undercover team who gets into some trouble when they steal some money from a haul they find and try to hide it, and the reasons why that happens. It's kind of cool. A few other people in that one, apart from Arnie, Sam Worthington's in it as well. Olivia Williams is in it. It's a very hardcore kind of film and slightly out of normal for Arnie, but now that he's reinventing himself as a grizzled character actor, it's interesting to watch the movie. It didn't get a lot of love from the critics, but I kind of enjoyed it while I was watching it, even though it is a very dark film. Using the word enjoy is something you kind of do with quotation marks around it to a certain extent, but it's worth checking out, and some good action sequences in there as well, and the ultimate mystery is kind of worth sticking around for, and there's a little bit of a mystery to it, which is kind of cool. Very gory, very kind of visceral, and some realistic gunshot effects in there, so if you're not the sort of person who likes that kind of thing, you may want to dodge it, but if you're the sort of person that likes it, groovy. The other bit of news I got, which is still wandering around the internets as a maybe, and we'll see how true it turns out to be, we'll know probably within a month or not, is there's talk and serious talk around the traps that Joaquin Phoenix is going to play Doctor Strange in a Marvel movie adaptation of that particular comic book character. And to be honest with you, I can see it working. I can definitely see Joaquin Phoenix playing Stephen Strange, the master of the mystic arts, the sorcerer supreme of the earth. And that's a kind of interesting choice too, and I think it really will work if that's the direction they go in. The negotiations, they say, are almost complete, but until there's an announcement, it still comes up as gossip and rumour. Nonetheless, I think I like it. If it does end up being Joaquin Phoenix, I like it as a choice, and I think it's a very wise choice for them to use him as one of my favourite Marvel comic book characters. Okay, it is time for a break now, and when I get back, we're going to be talking about the 1967 slightly campy, slightly silly horror movie from England, It, with an exclamation mark, starring Roddy McDowall and Jill Haworth, and it's also got a couple of other names too, Anger of the Golem and Curse of the Golem. So I'll be back in a moment and start talking about that one.
They say the world don't have heroes anymore. Well, damn them, Max. You and me, We're going to give them back, the heroes. Hi there. This is Roger Ward, Fifi from Mad Max, and you're listening to Martian Drive-In. Enjoy, babies.
And thanks again to Roger Ward for that. Every time I play that, I smile. Roger Ward is just the best. And we're talking about It, a Gollum movie of very unusual nature, really, from 1967. It was produced by Seven Arts Productions, who had the rights to distribute a bunch of Hammer stuff and wanted to make a horror movie pretty much in the style of Hammer, similar cinematography, that beautifully saturated Technicolor look, and pretty much along the same lines. They'd distributed, let me see, Plague of the Zombies, for instance, and Vengeance of She, they distributed about a year after this. Dracula, Prince of Darkness. So they do that. They're also a kind of semi-high-end production company in America, because they did a few films that I kind of like Sunday of New York in 1963 with Rod Taylor and Jane Fonda. Night of the Iguana, which I talked about on Paleo Cinema. Let's see what I've got. 7 Days in May, another one I've talked about in Paleo Cinema. Is there a movie I haven't? And they decided that they were going to kind of put a little money in, get Roddy McDowall, who was pretty much a name at that stage, even though he was for a lot of the time doing television and made quirky little arty films like Lord Love a Duck for George Axelrod. So they got him involved in it, and then they got a director who, the only virtue I can see in the director Herbert J. Lederer, is that he was cheap. I'm taking a look at the director credits of this guy. He's got 7 director credits on IMDb. Pretty Boy Floyd, 9 Miles to Noon, a short film called The Child Molester, which I'm sure was a laugh riot. The Frozen Dead, which is about frozen Nazis. I think it starred Dana Andrews. This one, It, a movie called The Candyman, and one of the worst movies of all time, The Doomsday Machine from 1972, which I believe may be on YouTube and is definitely on archive.org. But unless you really want to waste an hour and a half of your lifespan, I don't recommend that you view it. So this guy was kind of like a very much a B-grade schlockmeister in a sense. But the movie, I'll do the synopsis from IMDb because it's pretty much hits all the marks and gets things going. Let's see. After one of their storehouses burns down, a museum director and his assistant Pim find everything destroyed with one exception, a statue that withstood the fire damage. Suddenly, the museum director is lying dead on the floor. His assistant, Pim, played by Roddy McDowall, sets out to find out as much as he can about the statue and use it to his advantage. The golem, he finds out it's a golem. The golem has been created by Rabbi Judah Lowe, a great rabbi in Prague, and was given life by supernatural means in the 16th century. The golem is cast of some physical manifestation of the ghetto's inhabitants' collective psyche. Golem was brought to life against its will and wrestles with his particular form of the human condition. I don't know why they put this crap in there, but anyway. Golem withstands every human attempt to destroy it. Pim decides to use it to his own advantage. In the end, Pim realizes the Golem does not respond in accordance with his plans. Now, that's pretty much a fucked up kind of thing, but you get the idea. Pim finds out that this thing's a golem, finds out how to control it using a little scroll that he finds in a secret compartment in its foot. And if he puts the scroll in the golem's mouth, he can command it to do pretty much what he likes. So before he finds the little scroll, he takes a rubbing from some of the Hebrew written on the side of the golem, which kind of looks like Groot in a dress, and takes it to a rabbi. And the rabbi translates the Hebrew into English. And I'll just play the little audio from that because it's kind of cool. And it's one of the coolest bits of this fairly benighted but very amusing movie.
This is a most rare thing. I don't believe that you got it off some stone, as you said. If I translate it for you, will you agree to tell me the truth? He who will find the secret of my life at his feet, him will I serve until beyond time. He who shall evoke me in the 17th century beware, for I cannot by fire be destroyed. He who shall evoke me in the 18th century, beware, for I cannot by fire or by water be destroyed. He who evokes me in the 19th century, beware, for I cannot by fire or by water or by force be destroyed. He who in the 20th century shall dare evoke me, beware, for neither by fire nor water nor force nor anything by man created can I be destroyed. He who in the 21st century evokes me must be of God's hand himself, because on this earth the person of man existeth no more.
And you thought the product warnings on toasters were pretty extreme. I kind of like that, the way that the music gets a little bit tense when they do that. And Roddy McDowell's character Pym is almost licking his lips with anticipation to have that much power. He's a weird kind of character, and it's a little bit, the movie's a bit like what would happen if Norman Bates found a golem. Now, I say that very advisedly, because there's this totally unnecessary subplot where Pym actually has the corpse of his mother at home, and he steals jewellery from the museum for her to wear overnight and then replaces it before anybody finds out about it, which is kind of not really an indication that the guy's got all of his wheels on the track. But Roddy McDowell puts it across, and his tongue's always slightly in his cheek here, and he's kind of got this crush on the daughter of one of the people initially killed by the golem, a woman called Ellen, played by Jill Haworth, whose biggest claim to fame really is that in the original 1965 version of Cabaret on stage in Broadway, the one that Bob Fosse directed and Joel Grey played the Masters of the Ceremonies in on stage, she was the original Sally Bowles, the character that Liza Minnelli played in the movie, for Cabaret at the time. And here she is about a year and a half later playing kind of the love interest in a really schlocky little English horror movie. So I'm not sure what happened then, but it does seem a little out of character. And there's a really weird fantasy sequence in the film where Pim imagines her lying prone on a couch with only a small cushion to protect her modesty, looking at him and telling him that she wants him. And then when Pym approaches the couch, it turns into his dead mother laying on the couch. So there's that weird little bit in there, which has got nothing to do with the rest of the movie. It's a totally unnecessary subplot, this kind of Norman Batesian thing with the dead mother. But nonetheless, it's in there. And Pym, of course, wants to be the museum director and wants to be the youngest one in England, even though Roddy McDowell was 41 at the time. He played a lot younger than he was. And then, of course, Ellen is not at all interested in him because, apart from anything else, he's fucking weird. She's interested in the guy that came over from the States to buy the golem from the museum, a guy whose name is, and I've just totally gone blank, Jim Perkins, played by Paul Maxwell. Now, Paul Maxwell was a Canadian actor who worked in England for a long time. He was the voice of Steve Zodiac in the Gerry Anderson puppet series Fireball XL5, because they used Canadian and American actors for the American and Canadian voices a lot when they didn't use Australian actors. So he was the voice of that, and had a long career on stage, on screen, and doing voiceovers and animation stuff in England for a very long time. The only other really interesting people in there is Noel Trevathan playing Inspector White, the police commissioner. A lot of people don't know Noel Trevathan. I think he was a New Zealander, but he did spend the latter part of his career doing television in Australia, so that's where I know him from. Did just about every TV series in Australia during the 1970s and 1980s and became a very well-known and respected character actor there. But there's a number of weird things in this movie, apart from the fact that you've got a golem there and you've got Roddy McDowell kind of channeling Tony Perkins in a weird kind of Roddy McDowell pixie-ish way. And you've got that. Then he decides that what he's going to do to impress the girl. Now, this is the kind of way this guy tries to impress women. By the way, I don't recommend it as an approach. It really doesn't tend to work. He gets the golem to go underneath Hammersmith Bridge in London and shake the bridge to pieces just to impress it, because he told her he could make that bridge be destroyed if he wanted to. So he does that, and there's some really ropey special effects of the golem shaking up and down at some cross steel girders, and then there's a bad bit of model work of Hammersmith Bridge falling into the Thames River, which is kind of one of those kind of off-the-wall things that you don't really expect in a movie like this. Yes, you expect all the murders and things like that, because it's very consistent with a Hammer monster movie, which this production was really trying to emulate in a lot of ways. But you don't expect the Norman Bates bit. You don't expect him to get the golem to shake down Hammersmith Bridge. And then it gets even weirder, because he holds up in a new building the museum has out in the countryside, a big estate, and he basically kidnaps Ellen and takes her there, and also kidnaps the housekeeper who's looking after the museum property, and decides that he's going to keep them both there because nobody can stop the golem. So suck eggs, everybody. The golem's indestructible and you can't get at us in spite of that. But of course, conventional explosives haven't worked to kill the golem. So what the English government does, in its rather finite wisdom, is they're going to use a small nuclear weapon to take out the estate where the museum is now located, and by doing so, taking out Roddy McDowall and the golem with not a very big nuke. I mean, it'll only blow, totally destroy everything within a 1 mile radius, and they've evacuated people from a 5 mile radius, because apparently the people doing this have never heard of a thing called nuclear fallout. So they decide they're going to do that and basically nuke the golem, and by doing so, nuking Roddy McDowall. Now, Roddy McDowall decides he's going to protect that little scroll that's in the golem's mouth by getting the golem to swallow it. This gives the golem more autonomy than Pym really wants it to have. And so as things go, they do set off a nuclear weapon, and Jill Haworth's character, Ellen, escapes just in time and is running away from the property. And the Canadian boyfriend gets on a motorbike, starts doing a Steve McQueen over ditches and things like that to rescue her from the nuclear blast, which the people nearby, the police and the military, have decided they can be protected from a nuclear blast by a row of sandbags. And that's exactly what they do. And the golem ends up walking into the sea. Now, there's a few things about this movie. I kind of like the audacity of it. I like the fact that they go, okay, what can we do here? How are we going to get rid of the golem? The golem's indestructible. We said so. And we had the Jewish rabbi saying so at the start of the film. How are we going to get rid of the golem? Well, we could try a nuclear weapon. No, but the prophecy says you can't use a nuclear weapon to destroy the golem. So what are we going to do? So they find the way to get the golem autonomy, and the golem walks into the sea. Let's hope it doesn't come out in the 21st century, because the prophecy is a little bit extreme when it comes to the 21st century, saying basically it's going to just raise the earth. Though that would, of course, give something like the Sci-Fi Channel the opportunity to do one of their wonderful little Sci-Fi Channel movies as a sequel to this one. But I wouldn't recommend it. The other weird thing about it, which people have mentioned a little bit when they've reviewed the film, is the fact that even though it's set in 1967, the movie is totally straight-laced. Everybody dresses and acts pretty much like it's 1959, before Beatles, before Carnaby Street and the pop music really kicked in, before youth culture. Even though Jill Haworth's character does dress in a miniskirt and with a modern hairstyle, everybody else seems to have come from the 1950s, which gives it a kind of temporal dissonance that's a bit weird. Now, the movie, of course, isn't very good. The pacing's sometimes off. There's a bit of padding in the middle. I mean, you could consider the subplot with the mother and the subplot with Hammersmith Bridge to be padding as well. They needed something big to happen, because the off-screen killings of people by a great big Groot-like statue really doesn't cut the mustard when it comes to that. So they obviously had to put something big in there, and the destruction of Hammersmith Bridge fulfilled that part of it. And the script, of course, isn't as good as Hammer scripts. Hammer's scripts tended to be very tight, and the people acting in them tended to really inhabit the characters well. But Roddy McDowall really does have his tongue in his cheek here. It's an absurd character and an absurd bit of a movie. But he makes it work, and all credit to him as well. He gives it a good go and creates a genuinely weird character out of all of this surrounding absurdity. And there are times when he's trying to set fire to it to try to destroy it by putting it in a shed and setting fire to the shed. And he's giggling gleefully while he spreads petrol around. And there's a really nice scene that the camera's behind Roddy McDowall as he looks towards the fire and as he sets fire to the shed. And the shed goes up pretty quick, and you can see Roddy McDowall backing away from the shed. And then he turns to the camera and walks past the camera to the left of the camera, grinning madly like he really enjoyed setting fire to this shed for the movie. So there are lots of little bits like that that you've got to watch for in this film to just see the joy that he had. Obviously, it was one of those things. Nobody does this movie except to cash a check. Nobody does it to forward their career. It's basically a way of getting a little income in between jobs. But, the movie, I like it. I'm not quite sure why I should like it, which is the odd thing. I do like it, and now and then I'll watch it just to remind myself that, yeah, they did try to nuke him Gollum. They did have the Norman Bates subplot, and it's one of those things you couldn't get away with now. People would just see it as stupid and criticise it if it was done as a modern movie. Apparently Mystery Science Theatre 3000 did this film, but it's a kind of soft target for those guys because there are so many bits of it that you could really take the piss out of. It's one of those films that's probably best seen with a bunch of friends and a bunch of beer and maybe some steaks on a barbecue. You've just stuffed yourself full of food. You're a little bit merry. And you can sit with a bunch of people and just enjoy the stupidity of this film. But there's a place in the world for that kind of film too. Not every horror film has to be torture porn or a classic. Not every horror film, not every comedy. And to an extent, this movie can be interpreted very much as a comedy. Not every comedy has to have gut-busting laughs in it as well. It's a very typical product of those kind of small movie studios that were around Curzon Street in London at the time, trying to scrape together the budget to make something, selling the American rights to help with their cash flow, and just getting actors in for a day or two to do a little bit in a film. They're very commercial projects, and people did enjoy them at the time, I assume, because they kept making them. Of course, a year after this, Roddy McDowall went into makeup and made the first of the Planet of the Apes films in America and kind of cemented his place in cult cinema history, becoming the Andy Serkis of his day. So that's about it. There's not really much else to say about it. It's a Gollum story. It's stupid. It pinches from other movies. It's got a weird, fucked-up audacity to it, and I like it. So I'm going to take another break, and when I get back, I'm going to have a talk about a much more serious and interesting film, Phase 4 from 1974, directed by Saul Bass, who did all of those great title credit sequences for a number of movies, and starring Michael Murphy, Nigel Davenport, and Lynn Frederick, an actress who had a very interesting, albeit short, life. Like a warm summer breeze. just thought I'd throw in some cool pop music to liven things up a little bit and kind of mellow people out before we talk about a little bit of a challenging science fiction movie from 1974, Phase 4. It was written by a guy called Mayo Simon, who only did a few other science fiction projects. In the early 60s, he did a movie called I Could Go On Singing, which was a kind of tearjerker Judy Garland film. But the things that I kind of like him most for, he wrote Future World, the sequel to Westworld, in 1976, and he did a movie called Marooned in 1969, which was kind of like an astronaut drama. People like, it was directed by John Sturges, in fact, and people like Richard Krenarinik, Gregory Peck, David Janssen, James Franciscus, Gene Hackman, Lee Grant, a bunch of other people. I really should do that at some stage, even though it is, well, in some ways a boring film. But, yeah, but this one is quite interesting. Now, there are a couple of science fiction tropes that really work well in this. When it comes to writing, show, don't tell is always a good one, and this movie very much shows you what's going on and lets you interpret it. And the other thing is that it's very difficult to write alien species that think as well as human beings, but not the same as human beings. And I think this movie kind of succeeds in that. I'll do a little bit of a pricey for it because it is a bit of a challenge and a little bit of an interesting piece of work. Actually, what I will do is I'll play the narration from the start of the film done by Michael Murphy, which kind of sets it up nicely.
That spring, we were all watching the events in space and wondering what the final effect would be. Astronomers argued over theory, while engineers got pretty excited about variables in magnetic fields. Mystics predicted earthquakes and the end of life as we knew it. When the effect came, it was almost unnoticed, because it happened to such a small and insignificant form of life. One biologist, an Englishman, Ernest Hubbs, saw something, got nervous, and started investigating. While I was playing around with number theory at the university, Hubbs was already onto something. Ordinary ants of different species were doing things ants don't do. Meeting, communicating, apparently making decisions. By summer, the rest of the world had moved on to other things. But Hubbs kept making notes while the threat grew. Only fragments of what he knew got out. He kept most of it to himself. So when I got into it, I didn't know a damn thing.
So that's basically what's happening. Ants in Arizona are starting to communicate with each other across species and collaborate with each other. And Hubbs, played by Nigel Davenport, a great English character actor, is studying them. So a lab is set up in a geodesic dome with a whole bunch of pipes radiating away from it where they can study a very unusual structure that the ants have built. It's a series of about six tall towers, not unlike termite mounds, but they're rectangular and they have a kind of tilt at the end of them, so they end up looking like steam whistles in a sense. There's a cant at the top of the towers and a little gap where ants can view the surroundings from a height. And Hubbs brings on the Michael Murphy character, a guy called James Lesko, to do the number theory. He wants to try to communicate with the ants because he knows the ants are doing something really extraordinary and really unusual. And he wants to communicate with them. Now, the movie was directed by one of the people who has contributed a shit ton to cinema history in very different realms. This is the only feature film that Saul Bass made, but if you have a look at his Wikipedia page, he was known for his title sequences and movie posters for films. I'll just give you a rundown of some of the movie title sequences that Saul Bass worked on in cinema. Let's see, Carmen Jones, The Big Knife, I've talked about that before, The Man with the Golden Arm, The 7-Year Itch, Let's have a look here. Bonjour Tristesse, a film I want to do on Paleo Cinema Podcast at some stage. Anatomy of a Murder, North by Northwest, Psycho, Vertigo, Ocean's 11, West Side Story, Walk on the Wild Side, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, Bunny Lake is Missing, Grand Prix, Seconds, the Rock Hudson movie, That's Entertainment Part 2. He even did the title sequences for Goodfellas, Cape Fear, and Casino. He died, let me have a look here, in 1996. And not only did he do title sequences, he did a lot of posters. He did corporate logos as well. He was a graphic designer by trade. But in this movie, he brought that kind of visual sense that he has to the film in really interesting ways. There are a lot of really good close-up images and sequences of ants moving things around, ants being produced by the ovipositors of the queen ants, other insects attacking ants and then being attacked by ants. Basically, he uses at least 50% of the storytelling is told not from the viewpoint of, but by showing ants doing things. There's a sequence where Hubs spreads a yellow poisonous goop all around the station that they're working out of. And there's a sequence where an ant takes a sample of this goop back to the nest, and one ant will carry it so far and then die, and then another ant picks up this chunk of yellow crap and moves it a bit further and continues until they get it to the nest so it can be analysed and the ants can be made resistant to it. Now, none of this is said. It's all just done visually and shown visually in the film, which is really eerie and strange. Now, there's a farm nearby which is attacked by the ants, and a girl played by Lynn Frederick is the only survivor of that infestation. And the infestation is done a really interesting way. They try to fight off the ants. It's a little bit like The Naked Jungle with Charlton Heston and Eleanor Parker fighting off the ants, only with the actors nowhere near as charismatic. But Lynn Frederick's the only survivor of this infestation because they try to run to the station to get help just as Hubs is shooting out the yellow poison, and the other people on the farm are killed by it, but Lynn Frederick's character survives by hiding in a cellar. Lynn Frederick, really interesting actor. If you have a look at her IMDb and her Wikipedia page, she's not really treated nicely, I don't think, in those pages, because she's considered the ultimate Hollywood gold digger in some ways. She married Peter Sellers and was his wife at the time he died. He was about to divorce her, but he died before he got the opportunity to. And so she inherited his fortune. His family didn't. His children got something like £800 out of the deal. But she then went on to marry David Frost, the TV interviewer, before he was Sir David Frost, and made money that way. But it didn't serve her ultimately in the end. She'd have a child who inherited all of the money she inherited. But she died at the age of 39 of alcoholism, which is kind of sad, but the odd thing about her IMDb page in particular is how unkind it is to her. Now, I don't know all of the facts of her life and whether she was a gold digger or whether she was genuinely in love with the people she married, though they did advance her position in the world significantly. But she's in there as well. She's supposed to be playing an American, but she's using a very kind of cod American accent, and one of the problems Saul Bass had was trying to get her to speak with an American accent, so there was a lot of he made her run a lines with him so that she could kind of get there. The film wasn't actually filmed in America. A lot of the all the interior sequences of the film were done in Pinewood Studios in the UK. But the outdoor sequences in the desert, which is supposed to be Arizona, were actually done in the Rift Valley in Kenya at the time. And that makes things even more eerie and interesting. And as the attacks increase in the movie, as the ants find ways to kind of stop this station from being a viable place. So they do a couple of things, one of which is they knock out the air conditioning system in there by having a praying mantis, which they goad into being where it is, short-circuit the whole thing out and it catches on fire. Then they create new mounds after Hubs blows up the old termite kind of mound, the geometric termite mounds they have. They build new mounds with shiny kind of mica or silica on the surface, which reflects sunlight at the dome. So there's concerted effort to heat the dome up by these ants. And all of that is really, really scary and spooky and very, very evocative. There's not another science fiction film like this. And all credit to Saul Bass for doing that. Now, this is one of those movies that didn't make money at the time, and only ever got a cult following a lot later when it was shown on TV. The other problem is that the studio who produced the film, and give me a moment while I turn the page and find out which studio it was, Paramount Pictures, basically destroyed the ending of the film. Now, the ending is one of those kind of transcendence endings where Bass is trying to tell a lot of story visually. And there's a little bit of a voiceover in the ending that we're given in the film itself, which kind of tries to cover things, but is a little bit of a dud. There was an ending that was found among the possessions of Saul Bass after he died, which was about a 4 or 5 minute sequence showing what happens when the ants take over. Now, it's all done visually. There's no dialogue in it at all. It's a lot of it's done with superimposition of images. And because, of course, there was no computer graphic work at the time, they really had to use the technologies they had and Saul Bass's very strong visual sense to do that. I found a YouTube video of that sequence. It's not the best quality in the world, but if you watch Phase 4 and then watch the sequence that I'm going to post both on the Facebook page and on marsdrivein.blogspot.com, you see what they were going towards. This is one of those science fiction movies that makes you think. And there's a large audience for science fiction films that don't want to be made to think. It really does make their brains hurt. But this particular one makes you think. And if you want to get the most out of the film, you really do have to watch the images carefully. You can't do it while you're looking at your Twitter feed or Facebook feed. You've got to pay attention to the film. The acting is kind of good. I think Davenport is the best of the three. Michael Murphy, a good jobbing actor. He did a whole bunch of stuff. I think he did a lot of stuff with Robert Altman. Good jobbing actor, but I think he's the lesser role in this one. And Lynn Frederick's in there for reasons which become fairly obvious towards the end of the film. But, and the other thing to mention about the movie is the electronic music and by David Vohaus and Desmond Briscoe, some of which I'm playing now. And there were three different people who did the music for this one. There's Brian Gascoigne, who did the chief music at the start of the film, Stormy Yamashita, who did the montage music, and Vohaus and Briscoe, who did the music here, which is kind of evocative, tonal, electronic kind of stuff that really works well and takes the movie, as do the visuals of course, out of the human realm and into something different. This is a kind of big transition for it. The Phase 4 of the title is an enormous transition point for life on Earth, which is kind of cool. And again, a lot of it is non-verbal communication. There's not the scientific stuff and the communication between people of course is there, but a lot of the plot of the film and a lot of the ideas in the film are not verbal ideas. They're visual ideas. They're parts of the sound. And that's a big ask for a movie. If an audience has to walk along willingly and can't be dragged along by what they're seeing and having things spoon-fed to them, then that's a big ask for a movie, particularly at this time. These days, this kind of movie might play a lot better because people are willing to go along with it. And I think that had it been made now and Saul Bass was still around, the use of computer graphics would have been fantastic, as long as they kept the ants as they are, because the ants are a genuine character in this film. They really are a major character. They're unknowable in a lot of ways. Their actions are their own, and their motivations are not anything like human motivations. They're very much they're very much the motivations of a hive mind. And that's a hard thing to put across in a movie, a really hard thing to put across. What else is there to say about this one? As I said, it was the only feature-length film that Bass made because it was a financial failure. But I don't think it was an artistic or a failure as a work of science fiction. I think that it's imperfect. The limitations of the visuals, particularly towards the end when they're trying to portray some form of transcendence and some form of mutation and alteration to human life on Earth. I think that there are limitations there. But I like the idea of the film, and I like the fact that they tried. So many science fiction films before things became easy to portray visually, you could see them striving towards an effect that would be a lot simpler, if more expensive these days, to do with the computer graphics we have now. But this film really does put across that sense of strangeness and that sense of unknowability of the intelligence these people are trying to understand. And I like that. I really do think that even though it's not a comfort film, even though it's not a film for watching with a bunch of people and getting drunk with, the way I mentioned it was, I think that it's an honourable part of the genre we like, science fiction. I think that it works. I think that it's ambitious. I think that it's, most of all and above anything else, and this is a word that becomes a bit of a cliche at times, it's alien. And more than almost any other alien, with the possible exception of the planet in the original Solaris, it shows us a kind of intelligence that we can never fully understand. And that's an achievement for a film. It takes us to weird, unknowable places and shows us things that are beyond anything that we've experienced in real life at a deep and visceral level. Yes, we've all seen ants. We've seen tons of ants. Some of us have burnt them with magnifying glasses, and others of us have poisoned them. But this is a good, solid look at a transcendence of the ants. And it's kind of, in a sense, I suppose you could say, it is to ants what 2001 is to human beings. There are transition points in human life where, you know, the guy, the ape man with a bone, suddenly decides to use it as a weapon. And the 2001 bit where the astronaut turns into a giant space baby. That kind of stuff. And this is the same thing for ants, in a sense. So, and I've got a lot of problems with 2001. I think it's slow and boring. But I don't find this movie slow and boring because the visuals are so striking. And like the ants moving slowly and progressing, the plot does progress with time. And it works for that reason. Now, there's not too much else to say about the film. I think it should be seen. I think there's talk of doing a Blu-ray release with the original ending intact on it, and I think that that's worth doing. I think that that's something that's going to sell okay and kind of complete the movie in a way that the studio didn't, and for that reason, more power to them. There should be more movie level of strangeness and a deep level of alienness to really fuck with our minds. I'm not sure how this would play out to people who were pharmaceutically enhanced. I could see it going either way, really. Good or bad trip. But, it's a good, honest science fiction film. There is a novelisation which keeps turning up in second-hand bookshops around Australia, done by science fiction writer Barrion Malzberg. Haven't read that in a long time. I do have a copy of it somewhere here, and I'm trying to find my science fiction, any one science fiction novel in the enormous stacks of science fiction novels in my closet. It's a problematic enterprise. But it's deep, it's strange, and it's worth your time. So I'm going to take a break now. When we get back, I'm going to do the feedback and close this puppy up.
In times long past, this planet was the home of a mighty and noble race of beings which call themselves the Krell.
And there are no bits of feedback. There is one for Paleo Cinema I'm going to read out next time around, but nothing for the Martian Drive-In podcast. I'm not getting any love. So maybe I've got to think up a question to ask people as a hook for feedback. Okay, here we go. Best performance in a science fiction movie before 1970 by an actor, and worst performance in a science fiction movie before 1970 by an actor. Now, it can be a male or female actor. I don't mind which. But put your brains in and give me some feedback on that. I've got no idea. I'm going to have to figure it out for myself, which I consider to be the best and worst bits of acting in science fiction movies before 1970. But have a go at that. Cultguru@gmail.com is the email address, KULTGURU. You can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook or friend me up personally on Facebook. I don't mind. And the other thing I've got to mention is the Patreon campaign. Go to Patreon, patreon.com/paleocinema, one word, lowercase, no dash. And you can become a subscriber to the podcast by donating as little as $1 per month to my humble little efforts. And if you do that, you get what is to follow, which is the credits for Paleo Cinema podcast and the Martian Drive-In podcast. So just before I do the credits, I've got to say, keep watching the skies, keep watching good movies, enjoy yourselves, look after each other, and I'll be back in 2 weeks with another one of these. Oh, by the way, the other bit I've got to put on to the end of the credits is Amazing Matt-O-Matic is our rattlesnake wrangler for the podcast. And as usual, thanks to the people who have subscribed via the Patreon campaign and donated just a little bit of money toward the podcast recording costs. And as a part of that, everybody gets a credit in the style of a movie credit. So we have to thank Alyssa, our location scout, Tansy, the Foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher, the gaffer, Chris, the camera operator, Julia, the casting director, Jan, the dialect coach, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the music director, Armin, the key grip, Tom, the focus puller, also known as the first assistant director, Sarah, the special effects director, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, and Sally, who is the assistant to Mr. Frost. Thank you to everybody who's been involved. And if people do want to get involved, they can go to patreon.com/paleocinema.